Well, good afternoon, everybody, and good morning, depending on which time zone that you're in, and welcome to this webinar on the evolution of foreign exchange benchmarks. My name is David Clarke. I'm a member of the Bank of England's Foreign Exchange Committee. I'm a former president of ACI, and I'm a director on the board of Refinitiv Benchmark Services Limited, which is the producer of WMR. I'm joined today for this panel session by Shirley Barrow, who is the Chief Executive of the RBSL, Refinitiv Benchmark Services Limited, Benchmarks and Indices, by Mark Lawler, who's the Head of Markets Transformation at NAB, and Stuart Simons, from the Head of Currency at QIC. We also have with us, I'm very pleased to say, Dr. Guy De Bell, Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, and who chairs the Global Foreign Exchange Committee. Guy was also the co-author of the report on foreign exchange benchmarks, which was published by the Financial Stability Board in September 1914. That report did recommend some changes to WMR after the issues that we'd had with the fixing problems earlier in the decade. And there were three particular changes that were recommended in that report relating to methodology, the governance of the benchmarks, and to the length of the window. Now, that was 6 years ago. A lot has happened then in the foreign exchange market, and especially with technology. A lot of people are much more used to using the fix, but it has also thrown up one or two very interesting issues that received a great deal of comment earlier in the year concerning how the methodology worked, the result of the methodology. And it was as a result of that that Shirley and her team in the UK looked very closely at the entire framework of WMR and did a great deal of work to ensure that the governance aspects were working correctly, that the surveillance was working correctly, but above all, that the methodology was working. Shirley, can I come to you first, please? Could you give us an overview of what your team investigated and what the outcomes were?
Absolutely. Thank you, David, and hello to everybody. Much appreciate the opportunity to be here today. So, yes, I think, you know, we very much appreciate being the fact that we are providing a global FX benchmark. As you say, that the equality and the appropriateness of the methodology of WMR is, you know, is accurate and is preserved. You know, the primary objective of WMR is to make sure that we are providing the accurate representation of the FX market at a particular point in time and for every currency that we cover. You know, you touched on some really good points that, you know, some of the drivers behind what we have been doing over the last few years is driving transparency around what we do and how we do it, combining that objective really with the requirements of a robust methodology, which is absolutely paramount to provide that integrity and create a real credible benchmark. And also, you know, really driving that confidence and trust in users who, you know, have those high expectations, quite rightly, when using an FX benchmark. So at the outset, or certainly from Q1 this year, we've done a few things actually, because as I say, you know, it's really important that we assess how we're performing and how the methodology is performing. And I would pick on two things that we were quite focused on. One was doing some data analysis. And this data analysis was much more comprehensive than looking at what WMR was providing. This was really looking at the market structure and the market with which WMR, you know, sources data from. And we leveraged our monitoring and surveillance team here, who is an independent from our operations team. So they really were set with an objective of looking at the markets in a more, as I say, a wider view of it, looking at it objectively and looking to, you know, plot and analyze market movements, market trends, looking at the WMR, how that moves correspondingly to the market, what the market impact might be. And we looked at that over Q1 and from Q1 to Q3, and very much focusing on things like liquidity, volatility, you know, behaviors, intraday patterns and things like that. And I think, you know, we're at the stage now that we have this wealth of information from that data, and we're now taking the next step of that. What we're going to do with this data. So we have had some discussions internally, and we've leveraged some of the experience from our oversight committee, which has some really great market practitioner experience on that, and independent from ourselves, which is important too. We're also looking to discuss this data with our user groups, and I'll come on to those in a little moment. But, you know, it's really important that we get an understanding, again, of, you know, their views, their observations, and what this data might actually be demonstrating to us and might be helpful for us in moving forward. But also, it's not our data, so we are working with our platform partners, but we would like to work out what we can provide more publicly as well, because we do feel that it's really important, as I say, that transparency aspect and what we can do there to really further that and provide users with that greater kind of awareness of WMR in the market, and hopefully assist understanding when they're reviewing their WMR requirements and looking at, as I say, you know, the impact of the market, and also what behaviours and things might be, you know, might be displayed over that period. So I think, you know, the data analysis, as I say, and looking at that wider view and really driving that engagement is something that we are really focused on, and it's still in progress at the moment, as I suggested. The second piece I would pull on is around, we've been focused on highlighting awareness around WMR, and really driving some further engagement around that too with our users. With regards to the awareness, it's really focused on, you know, sharing more details around the methodology, articulating the framework within which we operate. So you mentioned, obviously, we're a regulated benchmark, so we are complying with the EU benchmark regulations. We are supervised by the FCA, and this obviously provides us a real construct within which we operate. It's important, I think, that the requirements of that are understood, and it is reflected through our methodologies as well. But what we've also been doing is trying to kind of raise awareness around some of the more interesting things too. So, you know, we did some public articles around WMR, and we have been doing more liaison with representatives within different regions, so FX committees. We've been updating the methodology document. So again, trying to articulate greater clarity into that document, provide more details in that document where we can, and really trying to, you know, do that education as well. So people have a real document of reference to help them understand what WMR is calculated. It's quite complex in places, but we have been trying to make it, you know, quite clear there. But a really important part, which I did want to touch on, was our initiative around re-energizing the user groups that we had. So as you mentioned, the FSB, one of the recommendations of the FSB in 2014 was around formalizing user groups. We've always had a kind of open door policy. You know, we're very happy for users to contact us with any queries, any challenges, any, you know, discussion topics. But quite rightly, it was identified, you know, there can be a real use of more formalized user groups. So we have these established. We have an Asia Pacific one, and we have a EMEA Americas one, which is combined. And what we've really been doing there is kind of, as I say, kind of re-energizing those, bringing the group back together, actually adding more people to the user groups as well, because we're always really interested in doing that, just to, so that we get a wide spectrum of users, both on the buy side and the sell side, and we can really get some, you know, constructive dialogue happening. So what that is, it's an informal forum, but it is, as I say, users. So it's those members that are really interested in what WMR is doing, how it's doing it, how it could do it better, what we should be looking at, and how we could be expanding it. So it's really, you know, their views, opinions, suggestions, discussions, enhancements. And obviously over this period, we have really been doing a bit of a deep dive on certain aspects, such as discussions around the market structure, and the impact on WMR, or vice versa, the impact that WMR has on the market structure, around the length of the window. Obviously, there have been some suggestions. Is the length of the window the right time frame? So at the moment, it's 5 minutes. Is that still the most appropriate window? We've been looking at the spreads and the dynamic mechanism that we have through that, and data sourcing as well. So I think, you know, we've been very active and we're hoping to bring more more visibility to that activity as well to our users who are really at the centre of what we do, and we really do appreciate that. The only thing I would finish up on, and before I take up the entire panel, is, you know, change is really part of the DNA of WMR. Obviously, it's been around for quite some time, and the way that we have sustained and moved forward has all been around making sure that we move forward with advancements in technology, advancements in the market, advancements in data sources, and advancements around algorithms. So change is really important to us, and it's really important that we engage, as I say, with users to drive that change, because it's important that that change is the right change, you know, achieving the outcomes that we would want it to achieve, that we understand the potential consequences around such changes. Inevitably, there always are consequences. And at this time, there's no specific changes identified, but we're still having the dialogue, having the discussion, and obviously having this opportunity today as well. So I think, you know, lots going on, and we're still working through some of these work streams as well.
Shirley, thanks. As we open this up to the panel, there's a great deal of work that has gone on. Could you say a few words about data sufficiency and how that relates to the traded and the non-traded currencies calculations?
Certainly. So in the WMR's methodology, we do distinguish between two types of currencies, as you mentioned there. One we call the trade currencies and one we call the non-trade currencies. And the differentiator there is that the trade currencies are principally the data is sought from the platforms. So at the moment, we have three trading platforms that we use in the calculation. We have Refinitiv Matching, we have EBS, and we have CurrentX. So if we are sourcing the data from one or multiples of those, then it falls into our trade currency criteria. And there's a specific methodology around that. The non-trade currencies are not currently liquid enough on any platform that we found, and therefore we don't have the opportunity to use transaction data for these currencies. Rather, it uses indicative data that we source from the Refinitiv platform. So it's still a very robust mechanism through sourcing the data, as there's multiple different data sources that we use, but it's not from a transaction platform. So just quickly going to the trade currencies, and as to your point, one of the key criteria for any kind of methodology is obviously that data sourcing and making sure that we have sufficient data upon which to calculate a methodology and a benchmark. So what we have now, I think, you know, we've had it for quite some time, but the in vogue kind of definition of it now is a waterfall. So I would suggest in our trade currencies, our waterfall mechanism is that our primary data is to use the executed trade data. But again, like we said, there has to be sufficient data for that to be used. If there isn't, then our secondary, or our second waterfall, if you will, would be to use the order data. And then as a tertiary kind of last resort, if you will, we've got the indicative data as well. So we have those three layers in the trade currencies.
Okay, can I ask the panel then, Mark, can I come to you on this? Do you feel that the methodology that Shirley described there is well enough understood by the marketplace, and in particular the difference between traded currencies and those that don't have sufficient data, so they are taken from a different methodology?
Yes, thanks, David, and good morning to everyone else, and thanks for the opportunity to participate on this panel discussion. Look, I think the title for this forum about the evolution of FX benchmarks is totally appropriate. I can't believe it's 7 years ago since the significant changes that occurred, and it is evolving. And the first important thing to get right back then and even today is methodology, and to ensure that, you know, the wider community, both buy and sell side, has confidence in that methodology, and equally as important, the understanding of it. And look, I've been around FX markets probably too many years, and I know that this year in particular there's been some discussion. You know, we've had a significant test of reliability in the market through the COVID crisis, and particularly in March with the volatility rates. At some stages were quite extreme, and there's been some post-discussion around some data events that occurred. And whilst mythology is well understood by many, I think there's probably a range of level of understanding that still needs to be updated and communicated to the wider community. So, look, my question back to you, Shirley, in general layman terms, how is that FX benchmark come about when, you know, we've got 300 data points over the 5-minute window? Not to get into too much detail, but just for maybe for the benefit of those in the audience who don't have the most in-depth understanding of what's been discussed previously around the mythology of the FX, in particular for traded.
Yeah. Yes, on that point, actually, Mark, can I just remind everybody who's dialed in that if you wish to ask a question, please do so through the channel that you have, and we will put that to the panel. I'd like to come to Guy last on this particular topic of methodology, but Stuart, let me come to you. How important is it to you to understand the way in which the methodology has evolved in comparison with the way in which you, and particularly in your position at QIC, use the benchmark?
Yeah, thanks, David. I'm not so concerned about how it's evolved. I think we're all across how it's evolved, and I don't know, like, I think there's enough information from Refinitiv to make a determination of how the fix is determined, and while there has been a couple of stewards inquiries that we're aware of, I think there is enough information there if people want to seek it out. I don't know, though, that there is or has been enough really investigation or questioning from some users of the fix to really determine how much impact some of the flows actually have, and really questioning whether usage of the fix really meets their interests or objectives. And, you know, there are different objectives, of course, for different investors. But, I think there's a line of questioning that users of the fix can have to determine whether it really fulfills their needs.
Yeah, that's an important answer to the question, I think, because the user groups really, Shirley and the team rely on the user groups to let them know how people are feeling about that. Guy, can I ask you, when you did the work that was done back in 2014 and came up with the recommendations that you did in the report, what were your feelings then about the methodology, and have they changed in the meantime?
Thanks, David. Just before I get to that, I think I'd just like to note that it's really good to have Shirley on this webinar hit today and have her particularly talking to people in this part of the world. One of the things we've been talking about, the GFXE, would be great if WM got out there and talked to people, and here we are. So I think that's wonderful that Shirley is here talking with us today. I think it's important to separate a couple of things here. So there's the calculation methodology versus what you're using the fix for. And I think people often conflate them a bit, and then they blame, I'll use the word blame, maybe that's a bit unfortunate, but they blame WM for both. But WM's the calculation agent. That's what they're there for. The use of the fix, that's up to you, the user, and you should be asking a question, as Stuart said, as to why am I using this? Is this, is this what I want? Is it appropriate for my needs? That's up to you, the user. That's not so much a question for WM. WM is out there being the calculation for these FX benchmarks, and obviously particularly for the London 4 PM. I suppose when Paul Fisher and I did this work 7 years ago now, we were stunned at the lack of understanding of most users about the fix, and that very few had any understanding about the methodology at all, to be frank. And a lot of them weren't even sure, beyond knowing the name of it, really what it was about. Which, when you think about the impact that has on a lot of people's businesses and financial returns even, I find we did and find quite extraordinary. I think moving ahead to where we are today, I think people's understanding of it has increased quite a bit. So I think there is much better understanding of it now than there was back in 2013. But I still think there are people don't quite ask the question as to whether, you know, this whether they need to be executing around the fix, whether that is the right time for them to be doing that. And that said, I think we've got to separate that question from the calculation question. You can understand the calculation, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's fit for purpose. But I think there is much more visibility around the calculation now. People sort of, I think, broadly understand how it goes. They don't necessarily understand the detail, but maybe that's okay. I think the question, I think, has moved on a bit from the calculation methodology to the why.
Okay, now with that, let me come on to the why, Guy, if I may, in a minute. And I will actually start, we'll probably come back to you with that again. But can I just ask two more questions, Shirley, on or raise two more issues to see if they are issues on the methodology? One relates to the calculation of cross rates, and the other to the use of the median versus the average. Have you had, Shirley, you know, in the last few months when you've been looking at that, have you come to any conclusions about whether or not anything can be improved in terms of the methodology in respect of either using cross rates in a different way or using averages in a different way? And I please invite the other members of the panel to comment on that.
Great. So just to start off, so just as I mentioned, at the heart of WMR is around creating a benchmark which is an accurate representation of the market, but also combining that with protecting the integrity of it and promoting that trust and confidence. So it's really, you know, combining those requirements. And therefore, there's a number of variables in the methodology designed to achieve that. So Mark mentioned a few moments ago about touching on the methodology and, you know, giving a sense of that. And as you said, you know, there's a couple of things you mentioned there with regards to some fundamental points in the methodology. Couple of things that I would mention around the data sourcing, firstly, is around the fact, as I mentioned, we use transaction data, we try and use the most appropriate data source that there is for a currency. We sample that data over that five-minute window. And although we capture data through that five-minute window, actually, we're capturing data on a 24-hour basis, so that we see the market around those times as well. And of course, we have our intraday service, which provides, you know, the trade currencies every 30 minutes. So we're very focused and looking at the markets all the time, rather than just, you know, say, you know, actually looking at a 5 minute snapshot. And one of the things that we recognize as well, as you say, moving forward into the calculation piece, is there's a number of ways of calculating a methodology. And we use the median. So just to back up a little moment, what we do from a trade perspective is we sample the paid and given executed trades from the platform. We define a two-way price from those so that we apply the spread from the top of the book to calculate the other side of the trade. So in essence, for every executed trade, we actually have what we would term a bid and offer rate. And the next part of the process is, to your point, David, that we then calculate a median of the bid and a median of the offer independently. And, you know, there's been dialogue and discussions quite recently, even internally, around the use of the median versus the average. And one of the real qualities around using a median is that it gives you kind of greater opportunity, shall we say, to remove the extremes. So it has that that advantage, and therefore creates a kind of more stable view of the time period. It's also, you know, recognised as a good statistical method for calculating the middle, if you will, when there's not a kind of standard distribution, and when obviously we're talking about FX markets, that's unlikely to be consistently achieved. And I guess the other piece of it as well is that it's actually more robust. So, you know, to influence a benchmark is more difficult from you when you're using a median. So actually, we had a conversation with our oversight committee about this quite recently. And given that we are doing this balancing and combining these multiple requirements, you know, the outcome of that was we felt the median was an appropriate method. There are others, absolutely, but given this juncture and given the requirements that we have, and ultimately it provides that accurate representation of the market, yes, the outcome of that was that we would persist with the median at this juncture. I think, you know, other things that to mention regarding the methodology is that, you know, there's an awful lot of validation processes that have been built into that. So again, around that validity and the accuracy of the methodology. So we have, we talked about data sufficiency a moment ago. So we have those minimum thresholds to ensure that we have enough data. We do quality assurance validation checks on every piece of data, both the data that we're capturing, but also the kind of calculated benchmark rates before they're published as well. So, you know, for completeness, we have quite a in-depth, reasonably, perhaps complex in places methodology, which, as I say, we're trying to make more clear in the documentation that we have. But there's a number of steps that we are combining the requirement for making sure that the data is accurate, representative, and also robust.
Good.
Just that's touching on the point. So the cross rates, as standard, we produce the data to dollar, sterling, and euro, and a few additional ones, such as the Australian dollar, at particular times of the day. And we have limitations in those cross rates. You know, we're very clear that in our methodology, some of the calculations that we don't take in, for example, the T plus one, T plus two settlement differentiation. But again, in our methodology, we are very clear about how we do the cross rate calculation and the limitations that has currently.
Okay, thanks.
David, can I just jump in?
Please, yeah.
Just very quickly. One thing I should have said, and Shirley brought it up, is I, and really validate what she says, is I feel that the methodology is much more robust than it was, and more data sources, as Shirley said. So that was one point I really should have made in terms of material improvement than 7 years ago.
Okay, no, thanks for adding that, Guy. And I actually reread the report yesterday, and you refer to that in the report. This is a good time to have our first poll, because all of you dialing into this and listening to this, you'd have heard what Shirley said and the contributions from Guy and Mark and Stuart. We've got a poll question for you, which is, do you believe there are better methods to produce similar or better results? It's like a big exam question, that one, but it's pretty important, and you've heard how much effort goes into the methodology. You're not expected to say what the methodology should be, by the way, but do you think that the methodology is doing the job that it should do, or would there be better methods available? Let's move on to the theme which Guy raised a short time ago, and which has taken up, as Guy mentioned, that a lot of our time in the Global Foreign Exchange Committee and the subcommittees that work around that, and that is the use of a benchmark. Now, Guy, let me put you on the spot a bit here. When you, with Paul Fisher, looked at this, what we're looking at here is a fixing which becomes a benchmark or a reference rate or an index. I'm not quite sure. When you looked at this, how did you feel about the product and what the users wanted out of the product?
That's an interesting question, David, because to some extent, I'm not sure that many of the users thought about what they wanted out of the product at all, and that was part of the problem that Paul and I highlighted. A few more people thinking more about what they wanted out of the product would have actually been a good thing. But to get to your question, the thing was that people were using it for everything. So if you're using it as a valuation tool, then fine. You need something like this to value your portfolio on any given day. So that's fine. It's the transition from that to an execution tool, I suppose, which is where I think some of the thought processes didn't really go. And a lot of the thinking was, well, when you say, you know, it was, as long as I get the fix, then I'm fine, rather than asking the question, is the fix what I actually want to be getting? You know, is that actually best execution for me? Is that the sort of, is that really where I want to be transacting? I said, you know, generally the presumption was if I've got zero tracking error, then job done. I'm a fixed income person or I'm an equity person and I don't understand foreign exchange. It's like, well, yeah, but you're running a global portfolio and FX is going to have a material impact on that portfolio. So at least a bit of understanding about what you're doing here or what people are doing on your behalf here wouldn't go astray. So I do think there has been a lot more questions asked about that, but I still think there are more questions which could be asked by market participants about that. And I suppose to that point, and Mark mentioned this earlier, back in March, ahead of the March quarter end with the GFXC, we were somewhat concerned about the volatility which was around at the time and what that might look like. And we did put out a media release which did to ask people to think about what they were doing, consider whether they needed to be executing at March quarter end, and just highlighting that there probably would be a reasonable amount of volatility. In the end, it actually wasn't too bad, but there did seem to cause some behavioural changes and people bringing forward some of their transactions ahead of the quarter end, which does at least indicate that some people are thinking about what they're doing and how they're doing it.
Yeah. Stuart, I really must come to you next because you're a real live buy-side user. Let me ask you a simple question. Why do you use a fixing?
Or do we use a fixing? And there are occasions for it. Yeah.
Do you use a benchmark? That's why I mentioned... Yeah. Sorry, Cameron.
Yeah, I think one of the points that Guy mentioned is you need to have a differentiation between using a fix as a reference rate to value portfolios, but also on the other side of that is executing at the fix. And just on that executing at the fix and just thinking of users in general, just to add a bit more context, I guess, to what Guy mentioned, there are a lot of attractive attributes around executing at the fix because it's got heightened trading volumes, very deep and liquid markets. There are lower bid-ask spreads. You've got the possible netting of orders with other participants. There's the aspect of greater transparency that you get from that reference rate, particularly where there might be perceived conflicts of interest. And there's also a sense that users can generate operational scale from that. And there's, you know, I don't think there's any dispute about those points, but one of the, or probably the main thing that people aren't really considering is that the user of the fix is exposed to that net order flow during and even before the fixing window. And really, this is an unobserved cost of trading at the fix, which often has a material market impact because each individual user, they really consider their own self-interest. They think that their own individual flow is not material enough to impact the market during such a liquid period. But however, when you consider that collective of participants who are operating in the same direction, this does generate a very significant market impact, often even before that fixing window begins. And that can act as a real disadvantage for users at the fix. So I think it's important when we think about the considerations of whether users should be thinking about operating at the fix, you've got a visible trading cost, which is some type of brokerage fee that you'd have with your counterparty, but you also have to consider that implementation shortfall from the market impact. And obviously, there was quite a lot of that through the COVID crisis earlier in the year.
Yeah, has that been, I mean, what you're saying, is, I think, is that there's a lot of concentration risk you get around that fixing period. Has that been intensified by the increase in use of passive funds amongst fund managers?
I think the most obvious examples that you get, David, are when you get large movements in equity markets, and it can be exacerbated by passive funds, but it can also be exacerbated by rebalancing flows. So, for example, okay, when you have large equity market moves to the downside, and as investors look at their hedging book, they'll need to rebalance their hedges. They'll need to sell their base currency and unwind some of the hedges that they've got with their foreign currencies. So from an Australian investor perspective, you see that come through, for example, during the height of the crisis in March. On March 13th, the Australian dollar dropped about 2% in the hour before the fix. And that's in response to some pretty severe equity market moves in the prior 2 days. So you don't get this balanced fixing flow. You get quite an imbalanced fixing flow, and it has a significant market impact. And again, that's not coming into how Refinitiv calculate the fix. It's really that observation of how users participate in that fixing window.
Okay. Mark, let me come on to you now. How do you see this? Do you think that the fixing in any way creates tensions between buy side and sell side in terms of what you're expected to do with execution?
Well, I think the tensions, if there were any, if there were there or they still are, have decreased a lot. I think the improvements to the methodology and the communication to and the education of the market have absolutely, and things, releases of documents like the FX Global Code, have actually increased the awareness of the market, most importantly, from the buy side as well as the sell side. We've kind of focused a little bit on the FX spot side of the fix, but, the swap side plays an equally, as some would say, even more important part of fixing for the buy side. And the testing for the market through March, whilst it was unexpected, COVID and all the ramifications of COVID, was an excellent example of how the market was going to treat itself as far as liquidity management. And, relying on a bilateral relationship for your liquidity can be tested in those times. I think for the most part, the fix operated quite effectively through March, and that lends itself to give greater confidence to the buy side and also with a more efficient way of determining the fix, it lessens the pressure on the sell side. So yes, I think whilst there's maybe always a natural tension from buy and sell side, I think it's improved dramatically, and the example through March was evidence of that.
Okay, I've got another question on that, but before that, we do have a poll result from that first poll, which is, do you believe there are better methods to produce similar or better? Well, that's interesting. I've only just seen that as well. So that's something that we'll all take away, and Shirley, no doubt you and I will be talking about that, and we'll be talking with our colleagues. Do you have any immediate reaction to that, Shirley?
No, as you say, it's interesting. I guess what my immediate reaction would be to, receive feedback on what would be considered, an improvement.
Yeah.
We're always looking to enhance. That's absolutely, part of what we do. So and that's what we're trying to do with the user groups and that wider engagement that we've been talking about as well. So, we're always open to ideas, suggestions, feedback, and if there are different views, then absolutely, please share them. That's what's important for us to get that feedback.
Yeah, it is, and we'll take that through. Just one question that has come in, which covers a couple of topics, actually, but it's somebody asking why an equity fund would wait 2 days to rebalance their FX risk just to be executing at the fixing. It seems counterintuitive, says the questioner, which is a question we haven't been asked before. In other words, basically, why would you run the FX risk when you're actually covering an equity risk on that? Mark, can I come back to you if you've got any comments on that? Please, you can see the question there. Do you think, Mark, you mentioned the global code, which, again, is a subject close to all of our hearts. Do you think in the last few, over the period that we've seen since 2014 and during the period of formulating the principles of the global code, and, of course, the code comes out of the 2014 report as well, do you think there's been a major change in the way that the sell side sees execution in terms of acting as an agent or a principal? And is that still a dynamic that is changing?
Well, the Global Code's done a lot of things. Principle A, clarity on the manner in which you act, either as a principal or agent. It's given greater clarity. There has been an improvement in communication, and the Global Code has served as a vehicle of reference. It's heavily supported by the sell side as far as testimony and attesting to it. It needs to be greater attested by the buy side, but that is improving. Stuart's doing some great work on that as well. The market's, for the most part, principal. There is agency type execution, but it's really quite different than, for the most part, of a principal-based execution, which is, for the most part, fixed. I think the Global Code's done a lot of good work. It continues to do so, and the market's more informed.
Okay. Stuart, I know that you've probably got a comment on the question relating to the bifurcation of the equity and liquid and the FX risk.
Yeah, it is a good question, actually. And I'd say that the reason why often people use the fix to rebalance might be just out of convention, because their benchmarks that they might be following, they actually tend to rebalance at the end of the month, which again is also leaves the investor way out of structure and unprotected to unintended risks through that period. But again, this goes back to that point of users really understanding the purpose of why they're using the fix. And if you're rebalancing your portfolio, if you're an investor who is out of structure, then you're better off actually trying to get back into structure as soon as possible using, whenever there's a liquid market available to you. And the irony of that March 13 example that I used before, equities had sold off about 10% the prior 2 days. As people were rebalancing to unwind their hedges on March 13th, the equity market was roaring back at that same time and produced a huge upside return. So just as people were unwinding their hedges, they were really setting themselves up to reinstate them the following day.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting point. I mean, we all look now, I think, at March particularly as being a massive stress test for the market. We found out a lot about ourselves during that period and clearly hear about the fixings. But what you're saying is really helping to paint the picture. And thanks to the questioner for that question, because it does join up, I think, a couple of themes here. Why do people use it? Well, they're fund managers. What are people caring about? They've got several risks to care about. Let's move on to the next poll question and the next theme. This might have taken a long time to discuss a few months ago, but I think it's probably less of an issue now. Maybe I'm wrong on this, and that is the length of the fixing window. And here's the second and the last poll question. Do you believe that the five-minute window is sufficient, or should it be changed? Should you believe it should be shorter? 5 minutes is fine, or would you prefer to see it longer? Guy, let me come back to you on this one. I know that you agonised with Paul a little bit over this at the time. I'm not sure how I have been able to make a real judgment on this, because very often I've heard people say, well, part of the problem is the window. If there are huge orders sitting out there that need pre-hedging, you can't get everything done in the space of the window, which also puts a question mark over pre-hedging. Where does it fit into the execution principles? Do we solve the problem by making it longer? Do we mitigate it by making it even 5 minutes? I'm not sure I know how to make a real judgment on this. What was going through your mind with Paul when you looked at that initially?
I know at least Mr. Lambert, who's got a question here, will be certainly agitating for longer. So part of the thing, so recall, we started off, we were at two, right? So that's where we were. So I was comfortable in answering this question 7 years ago, which was, believe it should be longer. So we were pretty confident longer than two was desirable, just in terms of how much you were jamming into that 2 minute window. And so five is longer than two. and it's a number which is round. But we did actually think about 15 minutes, and then another proposition, and it partly comes to the question that Colin Lambert has asked on the thing, which is, do you need a different parallel mechanism for those using the fix as an execution method rather than an evaluation method? So if you think about it from an execution side, then you could argue potentially it's a longer period, but from a valuation point, the further you move the valuation, you know, it comes back to what Stuart was talking earlier. The further you move, widen the window, the less you may be trying to get, it's going to be useful to you as a valuation tool. So that is something you could think about. I suppose what we thought was, we'll try five. Five is longer than two. We'll see how that goes. And then it's an open question as to whether it should be longer. And I'm pleased to read and hear from Shirley and read in their user group minutes that that's a question that that WM is actively considering as to whether that does need to be longer. But it partly comes to Colin's question is, what exactly is the purpose you're using the fix for, as to what the answer to that question is? And just on pre-hedging, given you mentioned that topic, that is indeed one of the issues we've got under review in the three-year review of the global code. And we will be circulating a paper to foreign exchange committees possibly within the next 24 hours on that very topic. So in spelling out some of our thinking on it.
Well, that we look forward to seeing that. Mark, how do you feel about this issue on the length of the window? I mean, we were waiting with bated breath for Colin's question, which we get, and we do know the debate around this. How do you feel about the issues?
Well, if it's not broken, I don't think you need to fix it. I mean, it's something that was it was an estimate. And a lot of thought went into it, but then maybe at the end of determining, five, four, three, whatever it is, maybe in a little bit arbitrary, but it had to be longer. There's no doubt about that. How long? I think, five's a great first step, and there's going to be debate around it, and that's essential because, as this title of this discussion is, it's an evolution. But I think for the most part, 5 minutes works. And whether or not that's a minute less or a minute more, that's you're in the range of something which is working, I think, reasonably effectively.
Yeah.
So, David, mea culpa on my part, and it's a question of memories dissipating with age here. So, yes, as Paul Pepperbridge pointed out, it was actually 60 seconds. It was 30 minutes prior to the hour and 30 seconds past the hour. So it wasn't 2 minutes. It was actually one. So, yes, my bad memory on that one. So it went from one to five.
Yeah, it did. But, I think the original methodology, which obviously was inherited by what was then Thomson Reuters and obviously now Refinitiv, was focused around that. Well, we'll get the results.
Just to say last point, David, as hard as the duration is one thing, but it's also very important that, the transparency around the fee associated with that and the fact that banks used to offer this service for effectively free, and there was a lot of pressure around that.
Yeah.
And then, yes, extending the window was absolutely something, the right thing to do, but also the introduction of expectation of a fee, and they have that a global standard. And yes, of course, that fee is going to change over time, but that is obviously a very important part of this.
It's also critical in respect of the agent versus principal discussion that people have as well, because we're fitting several things into this window, which goes back to the point about, is it a reference rate? Is it a snapshot? Is it a benchmark? People do use it, I think, in different ways. We'll get the result of that poll in a moment, and we've only got a few minutes left. So let me move on to one other topic here. We have got close to it. We've got the results here. I hope everybody can see that. Well, there's still a debate. I'm sure that Colin's somewhere in the blue there. But you're just a short head behind, I think, with your view. But it's a very, very interesting poll, that one, and I think it's very helpful to Shirley to have that. And it tells us, I think, that we need to keep our eye very, very carefully on this matter. It is a big issue. And I think we probably need to say to ourselves at the moment, well, look, we have got, as Mark said, it's not broken. Don't fix it at the moment. But I think it's something we need to keep ourselves very, very aware of in a changing situation. So thank you all for voting on that. Let me just finish off then with a few words on the fixings for forwards and NDFs. Shirley, I'm right in saying really that this has come into particular focus because of the changes in benchmark regulation. And the forwards methodology and the NDF methodology is different. Do we feel that this has been working quite well since benchmark regulation changed? And I'll put that to you first, Shirley, and then maybe ask Mark and Stuart to comment on it afterwards.
Yes, happy to. So as you say, the forwards, the WMR forwards and WMR NDFs came into the regulatory scope from the beginning of this year. Fortunately, it's not really been a big shift from our perspective as an administrator, because we really had, you know, common practices that we used from the 4 p.m. spot. And we had a broad application of those. So, you know, whether they're policies or whether, you know, the oversight committees and things. So wasn't a big shift, but it was moving it into their line of vision. So it now is covered by our oversight committees, for example. But I think, you know, there are significant differences between our current methodology for the forwards and NDFs versus the spots. And inevitably, really, given the different instruments that we're referring to. But it's interesting because it's definitely been a topic of conversation most recently. And we've had some really good dialogue around it at the user groups as well. And looking at how we can really, you know, as we say, we're talking about evolution, how we can move the forwards methodology forward and enhance that for these benchmarks. And, you know, I'm actually really pleased to say that from the discussions and the dialogue we do have some enhancements in the pipeline. So, you know, from 2021, and there'll be further information coming on this because it will go to public consultation. But just to share some of the things that we are looking into are things like decimal places. We've had some requests to move out the decimal places and increase the precision there for the forwards. Looking at adding additional tenors, ceasing some particular tenors that are really illiquid. But more methodology focused, I guess, would be looking at introducing a calculation window. It's not something we have in the forward. So there's going to be a lot of debate, I think, of what that calculation window should be and the length of it. So we welcome that as we move forward in this process. And the other big piece has been around spread. And I think, you know, certainly to your point earlier around volatility, the focus on forward, I think there was a lot of movement in the spreads. So one of the things that we're looking at is how can we get more sophisticated around that? We have some really good dynamic mechanisms in the spot for the spread, and we're looking at how we leverage that and working, as I say, with the users to gauge what the requirements are. Because we recognise forwards are obviously a different data set than the spot. So there's a few things that are really active, and hopefully during 2021 and the earlier part of 2021, we'll be able to bring these to fruition. But there'll be public consultations on these, because obviously anything we change like this requires our users to have a voice as part of them. So I think, you know, there's a lot still going on. Yep. One of the things that we are still in dialogue around, and we don't have the ultimate solution yet, is around the data sourcing. So with the forwards, we have currently no transaction data as the data source. So there's no trading platform that we use for the forward. And that's principally because of the lack of liquidity of forward on these platforms. So we have looked at it. It's very concentrated in the really short time frame. So, you know, the overnight, the tomorrow, next, but really sparse after that. So it's not sufficient in order for us to use. So we are still working out where could we get, you know, better sources of data. Is it different types of platforms we need to look to? Do we need to be engaging more with the banks and understanding their challenges around providing data, compliance issues, etc.? So this is an area that we still, you know, we welcome dialogue on, and it's still an area that we're looking into.
Okay, well, that's really important. I mean, may I ask Stuart and then Mark to give us a quick reaction on that before we start to wrap up? Stuart, you particularly mentioned forwards earlier on as being very important to obviously the businesses that you're in.
Yeah, they are important. I think similarly to looking at the spot and the reasons for executing there at the spot, we've identified that there are systematic patterns that take place because users tend to concentrate some of their execution into month end when it comes to forwards. So, from our perspective, it's best to avoid it, especially that month end. And I'm not talking about, I guess, the determination of that, how that fix is calculated. But again, this is a behavioural issue, and again, it gets down to thinking about what the purpose is, and if that purpose is to try to mitigate trading costs, then we actively try to avoid rolling positions at month end when there tends to be a one-way concentration.
Yeah, interesting. And Mark, in terms of execution and in terms of the pricing of the forwards, how do you feel that this has been fitting in since the change in benchmark regulation? Are you comfortable with the way that this is landing?
Well, look, being a non-executed fix is going to be fraught with, it's not perfect. It is evolving, yeah. And Shirley, I thought, described that very well. There is going to be continued debate around that. And so there will be questions raised. And I think it comes back to the point that Guy and Stuart mentioned at the start, is this appropriate for you? So this is, yep. Is up for the individual buy side participant to understand what the structure on how those non-executed 4 points come about. It's not perfect. It is evolving. And whether or not it's better for you to, do you participate or do you go maintain a bilateral or multilateral relationship with other, sell side participants. So I think that kind of folds it way back into the original, what we talked about at the start of this discussion.
Okay, well, I think that's a point to, are there any final thoughts, Guy, that you have maybe on that before I wrap up?
No, not for me. Thanks, David.
Okay, thanks. Well, look, thanks to everybody who's dialed in. Thank you for the answers to the poll questions. I think we've got a great deal out of that hour. This is a real continuing working progress, and it's a very dynamic process. And there's clearly a lot of lessons to learn. There's also a lot of contribution to make. So I'd like to thank Shirley, you for joining us. You can go and have some breakfast now, I guess, which is what I should be doing. And also for explaining what you've been doing, and no doubt this will not be the last time we do this. You did particularly make a note of the user groups, and we would certainly like to see more people amongst the user groups. So anybody who's dialing into this who would like to be on a user group, please let us know. Stuart, thanks for joining us. I look forward to speaking to you soon on our favourite subject of the code and the buy side. Mark, very helpful to have your input and the discussions of the last few days. And to you, Deputy Governor, thank you very much indeed for giving up your time. And if I may say so, for probably being one of the people who started this whole business off. If it hadn't been for the work that you and Paul did 7 years ago, I'm not sure we'd be here today. So thank you to everybody, and thanks to Refinitiv and ACI for putting it together. Have a good evening or a good day, whichever is applicable to you.